Welcome to In the Loop with the Soup. I'm your host, Dr. Tremaine Clarity. This podcast is focused on all aspects in education that are happening right here in the Roane Area School District. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to In the Loop with the Soup. I'm Marcy Pfeiffer-Soderblom, VASD's Public Information Officer, here with Dr. Clarity, our superintendent.
Hello, Marcy. How are you doing?
I'm doing fabulous. It's a nice sunny day when we're recording, and we're joined by two guests today who make education accessible and engaging for hundreds of students every year. They are Dr. Sarah Hallberg, VASD's Director of Special Education, and Carly Adams, VASD's Behavior Support Coach and Extended Learning Pathways Lead. You might wonder what those areas are all about, and we're about to find out.
Welcome to In the Loop with the Soup. We're super excited to have two of our dynamic staff here on our podcast to share their experiences in service of students and in service of all of our buildings. And really want to think about, just take an in-depth look at specifically around special education and special education department, but really what does this mean in service to our students, our families, and to our staff. And with that, we're going to have our guests go into a little more detail, first about themselves, so we can know about their roles and how they impact our district. And then we'll get into some of the logistics of what do special education services look like and what do students experience here in the Roane Area School District. So I'm going to open up with Dr. Hallberg. Thank you for welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're excited to have you here as well. And so just for our listeners that I know many will know you, but those that may not, can just kind of go back and take us on a historical journey a little bit and tell us the journey of Dr. Sarah Hallberg.
Sure. So I started my career as a speech pathologist, and I was working in an adult group home and sheltered workshop setting in Michigan. And really what I did there is I helped adults really get out in the community. From there, I went into healthcare when we moved into Madison. My husband was getting his doctorate, and I worked in an acute care setting and learned a lot about co-treating with occupational therapy, physical therapy, and nurses. And I was also the assistant director of rehab at that time. From there, I went into the school setting and started as a speech pathologist. This was in the 90s. I was co-teaching as a speech pathologist in multiple language arts classes at the secondary level. And then I also worked in the 18 to 21-year-old program, again, kind of out in the community. From there, I was asked in that same district to become a program support teacher. And what that meant is just a variety of roles. So I did a lot of initial evaluations for students with IEPs to see if they met criteria for services.
And for our audience, IEP?
An individual education program.
Thank you.
And then I also provided a lot of professional development in the area of special education.
Excellent.
And so the last part I did there is really start up working with early interventions prior to referring students to special education. At that time, it was called Response to Intervention.
Okay.
And I helped develop a software program that was sent to the Department of Public Instruction to help with that piece.
Excellent.
I then became the assistant director of Title I at the Department of Public Instruction. And really, I worked with our governor, Tony Evers, which was pretty fun. I got my doctorate in 2012, and I've been a director of special education ever since. And just finishing up my seventh year here in Verona as the director of special education.
Excellent. Well, thank you. That's a great path and just a lot of curves, but they always come right back to Verona.
They always come back, yes.
Excellent. And I have to ask now, not to start anything, but I heard you say Michigan, and I heard you say your husband say Wisconsin. So what is that household? Like, who do we root for in this household?
This is a rough question.
Iowa.
Yeah. Oh. University of Iowa.
Talk about a curveball. Okay.
Uh-huh. So, we met at the University of Iowa.
Gotcha.
And so he got his undergrad at the University of Iowa, and I was born and raised in Iowa. So,
wow.
Hawkeye fan by always.
Okay.
Whenever the Badgers play the Hawkeyes, Dr. Hallberg always has on her Hawkeye gear.
And this moment in time on the radio, I'm speechless, but we're gonna let that go. But congratulations, and we're so glad to have you here. And Dr. say go Hawkeyes every time Only if they beat us, do I have to say go Hawkeyes?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I'll give you that. And Carly, again, welcome and thanks for joining us here today. If you could also, very similar to what Dr. Halberg just did, if you could just kind of help our audience get to know you on that professional and maybe a little bit on a personal level, like who's the person that makes up Carly Adams?
Sure. Yeah. Similar to Dr. Halberg, I had kind of like an atypical path to where I am now. So I did my undergrad at UW, so Badger fan through and through.
Good.
After undergrad, I went right into a master's program in rehabilitation psychology. So at UW-Madison, rehab, psych, and special education are in the same department. I had always intended to do transition age teaching. Found out when I was in my practicum that in the state of Wisconsin, you need a teaching license.
Correct, yeah.
Didn't know that, so then I moved to Iowa.
See?
And worked for the University.
You come from Iowa.
And I worked for the University of Iowa for 2 years in a post-secondary program for adults with intellectual disabilities that they offer at the university there. Madison's my home, so after 2 years, I was like, I want to move back. And became a case manager for adults with disabilities through Dane County Department of Human Services.
Got it.
So I worked with adults who were placed outside of their home kind of during deinstitutionalization. So the adults I worked with were between like 19 and 65. And I, my 2 years doing that, I was like, gosh, I wish I would have met these individuals when they were younger. And I was really curious about what their educational path looked like. And an opportunity came up at UW again, where they partnered with a national program for a grant to get your special education license. So I went back, got a master's in special education, and then was a case manager in a neighboring district for 7-ish years, and saw some really great things and some things I wanted to improve on. And we are a Verona family. We live here. And so I was kind of just waiting for an opportunity to come back. So I came back here in 2020, I think it was.
During COVID.
Yeah, I came back. I was a virtual case manager at the high school.
Wow.
And then I met with Dr. Halberg and Kim Griffin. I'm like, how can we get you here full time? What do you want to do? And I was like, I really want to make this position. It's called the behavior support coach and provide interventions for teams for students who aren't currently finding success. So Dr. Halberg hopped on and we kind of created this pilot position within the district and had really close data tracking, and it was effective. So then I've been here since then and now evolved into the Extended Learning Programs Pathway Lead. So we'll talk a little bit more about that as
Absolutely.
We get further.
Excellent. And so what we know to be true, especially I think in any field, but especially true in the field of education, is that we have to make sure that we are very clear and control our own narrative around what really happens in public education. I also know there's sometimes a counter narrative that is unfortunately intended to undermine real the fidelity of what public education really should be and means to all of our students. And so you think about specifically special education in a public school setting, how would you provide the correct narrative, Dr. Halberg, to what that means for our students?
When I think about public education and what that means, I always go back to, first of all, how is a student eligible to receive special education?
Correct.
And so there's really two criteria that we have to look at. One is, do they meet the eligibility criteria? So the Department of Public Instruction has 12 different impairment areas that are clearly outlined. Mm-hmm. And so our schools do testing to see if our students meet one of the 12 eligibility areas. For example, it could be autism, specific learning disability, emotional behavioral disability, speech and language. Impairment is another eligibility area. So there's 12 different areas. So that's the first part. The second part is, and the piece that often gets overlooked, is does a student need special education? Mm. And by need special education, what we have to look at is what can be provided by the general education teachers, and then in addition to that, what is required to have the expertise of a special education teacher. And if a team decides that a student needs the expertise of a special education staff, then in order to like have access and make progress in their education, then that is a student is eligible and is considered a student with an IEP.
Correct.
So you have to have both features. Sometimes people just think I have to meet the eligibility criteria, but it's really both. And I feel like in our district, we do a really good job of looking at, do we need special education? If a student needs special education, then that's where they develop an individualized education program, and it's called an IEP. That's done at least once a year, and there's a group of staff that get together, a special education teacher, a general education teacher, and then what's called a local education agency rep. So it's usually a principal or somebody like myself. Yeah. And so the IEP outlines the strengths as well as where there are gaps in the student's education.
Okay.
And what we do is we emphasize the student's strengths and then help build support to close the gaps in their education. So in public education, there's often some misconceptions about special education. For example, that it's a place. Special education is not a place.
Correct.
It is a service that we are providing. Sometimes I hear families say, I need a person. My child needs a person. Special education is not a person. It's really an individualized plan that provides support so the student can make progress. When looking at special education, we look at first what is a student able to do that's similar to all other students? And then what can a general education teacher do? Just like they work with all students in the classroom, a student with an IEP should have that same opportunity to work with our gen ed teachers. They are providing that core instruction. After that, we look in special ed as what are the additional supports that are going to help close the gap and give them access. And this is really where that special education is provided. It's providing that really explicit instruction for our students and then making adjustments to the environment and how the instruction is provided. Excellent. We also work really closely with our families as well as with our teachers so that they all have a say and that we're really working as a team to provide that support for our students.
Yeah, that's a great, and what I hope is our audience, as you want to know and understand, the great thing about these podcasts is just go back and just kind of listen to these specific strands over and over again, because there's a lot of specific detail in there that it just takes a while for all of us to learn and understand. Our audience and those within the organization as well. And I think the nuanced way that you described it really helps center the child, but also helps understand some of the legal components of it as well as part of the mandates from our federal government, and rightfully so. And they also are ethically appropriate. You know, we should provide services to all students in public education. So, Carla, I'm happy to expand upon Dr. Hallberg's answer, and especially in the area where she clearly stated we have to determine if you need an IEP. And with that, we know that there are still ways that you can support students, but that may not read directly through an IEP component. That's sometimes through a 504 plan. So can you help our audience understand the difference between an IEP and a 504? And almost like you think about a Venn diagram, there's probably be a lot of similarities and some differences and those things that sit right in the middle that are common.
Yeah, and Sarah, feel free to hop in when I miss a couple pieces here.
Sure.
But again, it goes back to those two questions. Is this a child with a disability, and does the disability adversely affect the child's educational performance? So it could be a child with a disability. It could be a child who has needs that are different from that of same-age peers.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's that second question of what does that child need to access their education? So an individualized education plan requires instruction that is specialized for that particular student with the expertise of a special education teacher or special education staff versus a 504 plan. And 504, it's from Section 504 of IDEA, is that correct?
I believe so.
Yeah. So back to our legal there. So it's a Section 504 plan. And that lists the accommodations that a student might need in order to access their general education environment. So that might be testing accommodations. That might be a student needs a snack during a certain part of their day because they have diabetes. A student might need a check-in with our school psychologist in order to start their day on the right foot. But all those supports can be, and accommodations can be provided in the general education environment and through general education staff or other adults who support all students.
Correct. And thinking, and I think beneficial for our audience as a person that's personally connected with the 504 beyond K-12 public education, that can also carry over and support into higher ed as well, where students are truly accessing and having accommodations based off specific needs, whether it's sometimes medical or just anxiety or things of that nature that allow for different types of access points that, you know, while we're talking about K-12 today, it does support our higher education learners as well. So it shouldn't be seen as something that would be a hindrance to your continued education. It actually supports continuing education.
Absolutely. When we think about job applications as students get older and what accommodations do you need to be successful in this job, right? And that self-advocacy of these are the things I need to be successful are outlined in a student's 504 plan and hopefully can serve as an advocacy tool for students as they get older and apply for jobs, apply for colleges, and you know what they need in order to be successful.
Excellent. So I'm going to start combining some questions together to make sure that we get into some details. But I want to frame this piece of it for our audience. And honestly, when I have, I hate to age myself like a quarter century of education. I get, especially in this leadership role, I get a lot of questions about a person or families that do not have students that have special education needs, trying to understand the services for that they don't personally experience as a family. And a conversation also often goes to a space where if a person or family cannot physically see a disability, they don't understand how the disability exists. And trying to explain things like neurodiversity is complex, but also it's beneficial to help understand the inclusion components of special education, but also helping that you're not always going to physically see, you know, different needs of our learners. So how would you help our audience understand some of the components of behavioral disabilities, and then how do you help also explain neurodiversity and what that means for some of our learners?
I'll let you start, Carly, and then I'll chime in on that since that's your area of expertise.
Sure. So I'll start with neurodiversity, and quite simply, that just means diversity of the brain.
Right.
So it's the concept that natural variation of the human brain is part of the experience of being human, and it encompasses any sort of neurological difference such as autism, ADHD, dyslexia, anxiety, all of those, what you said, a disability you cannot see, called an invisible disability most often. And that neurodiversity has now become the preferred umbrella term for any individual that experiences variation from the norm. But what we know is like norms are socially constructed, right?
Correct.
So in the state of Wisconsin and the Verona area, this is the norm, and you go anywhere else and that norm is slightly different. So again, neurodiversity changes based on where students are. Then your question about a behavioral disability, that is a student who has been labeled through the DPI criteria as an emotional behavioral disability. So again, it's a student is meeting an established criteria. A common misconception is that it's a loose criteria sort of based on anecdotal reporting, and is actually quite the opposite. In recent years, DPI updated the criteria for qualification for emotional behavioral disability to be more strict, to require more evidence that is in fact what the child is experiencing, and not the result of the environment in which they're in. So students must demonstrate behavior. So behavior, I'm doing quotes that you can't see, behavior meaning ways in which students or children act, broken down into different subcategories. And that student's behavior is significantly different from what we'd expect from same age peers. So again, we know that the student has behaviors that are significantly different, which is 2.5 standard deviations based on testing, right? So there is a pretty strict criteria for how you qualify, and it must occur across at least two environments. So oftentimes that's home and school. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's school and community, but ensuring that a student's behavior is not the result of the environment that they're in. So again, all this said of, it's not a willy-nilly, we think you have a behavioral disability. It's all of these sort of safeguards to ensure that, yes, this is a disability that is limiting this student's pro-social access to school.
And then just to kind of chime in on that, once we identify a student, what we want to be able to do is really teach. How are you going to learn new skills for both our teacher? How are they going to address a student? As well as how is a student going to learn? Because it is, we need the explicit teaching, just like we need to teach reading, we need to teach students the behavioral skills as well.
Correct.
And so that's an area that we're still growing in across our country.
Excellent. And then as we spend our last 2 minutes together, we want to think about and definitely acknowledge and support our staff that provide such deep services for our students and those that work closest to work. And our SEAs definitely need to be brought into this conversation as a key element of support, both from a relationship piece and some of this instructional support as well. So can you talk about our SEAs and then expand that into some of the additional access points that we have here, especially in the Roanoke School District, and that's for our extended learning pathways, which is about one semester in. I would say emerging and growing as we continue to learn more about that. So we want to talk about those two aspects of our
programming. So our SEAs are our special education assistants, mm-hmm. and they are working really closely with our students with IEPs, and they are often one of the main individuals who are working with our students in the environment. And we provide extensive support and training for our SEAs on our Late Start Mondays.
Correct.
Which has been fantastic. So a large part of our focus is really on how are we helping our students stay regulated, and when they do have low access moments, what are some strategies that we can use to help get them back into a state where they are able to learn other academic skills. So Carly goes and provides a lot of support. We have modules that we provide, we have readings, we have articles that we have used as well, so just a variety of tools. We also offer our SEA training in Spanish.
Good.
Because many of our SEAs are speaking both languages, and they find that having it in Spanish, they're able to interpret a little bit easier, so that's been super helpful as well. Regarding our Foundations program, we have found that with all of our support, there are a small number of students that need a different environment in which to learn their skills. And so we worked last year to really think about a program that would be helpful for our students, especially at the elementary level, to learn skills in a very structured environment. And so I'm going to turn it over to Carly, as she is leading that, to talk a little bit more about what that is and our outcomes thus far.
Sure. Again, this is we think about continuum of support, continuum of interventions for academics. Extended Learning Pathways and Foundations is on the continuum of interventions for behavior support. So we are the furthest end. We are the most restrictive environment for teaching behavior skills that students need in order to access their general education environment. So our two main focus areas are on academic participation, so learning a work break routine, so engaging in a task with an adult, doing something you really like, and then coming back to the table and doing it again. So teaching those skills of how do you do school, how do you participate? And then, as Dr. Hallberg said, regulation. So what does my body need in order to participate in the general education environment? So that's teaching students to notice internal states. So like, oh, my body's feeling like, I need to get up and move. What are my options to get up and move that are pro-social and will be able to be executed right in the general education environment? And doing it in a location that is quieter, that has less access from other students, right? It's the students and foundations and the adults that are supporting them. We don't access other pieces of the building. We don't transition to related arts. We eat lunch and breakfast in the classroom. So again, taking out all of those environmental variables that we know are difficult for students as they're trying to isolate learning those behavioral skills.
Excellent. I learned a lot in the moment just then.
Yeah. It's exciting to watch the growth. We've had incredible growth this first semester, and just hearing feedback from key stakeholders like building principals and case managers of like, I've never seen a student engage in this much work before.
That's phenomenal. Well, yeah. Thank you for your leadership with that.
You bet.
Absolutely. So any elevator speech that you want to put out there for special education, just for our audience as we close up today?
I guess for me, what I would say is our students with IEPs are general ed students first, and we really need to think about that and realize that special education is a service to help close our gaps. And our teachers are really teachers, special education teachers, that we really need to focus and give them the support so they can provide that instruction so that we can close a gap for our students.
Excellent. And I was taught a long time ago, when someone makes a mic drop moment, you don't mess it up. You just leave it right there. So we're going to close. Thank you both for being here and being such wonderful guests. And we'll turn it back to Marcy.
Thanks for listening today, everybody. If you have ideas for future podcast episodes, please email them to vasdinfo@verona.k12.wi.us. We'll see you next time on In the Loop with the Soup.